Good morning. We do. We have sound. I apologize for the little bit delayed start, but I will call the this special meeting of the Covered California Board to order, and then we will adjourn into a closed session as has been noticed. So I'll call the roll. Belshe? Farrer? Kennedy is on her way. Dr. Ross will be joining us by remote, which was also noticed in closed session and then in open session from Los Angeles. And of course, I'm here. So we have our quorum, and we will again ask for any disclosure of any conflicts that board members do. We will do that again at the open session, and we are now adjourned into closed session. On time the last time. We are once again behind, but as you all know, this is a very ambitious agenda, and I appreciate everyone's patience. I'm going to pause just for a moment till my colleagues arrive, and Dr. Ross is joining us by phone. I don't know if he's on the call yet, but he is in a public place in Los Angeles.
I am, Madam Chair. I'm not sure you can hear me. Diana? Hello?
Oh, you're here. Good. Welcome, Bob. We're waiting for our other colleagues to get up from the sixth floor. We were on a different level.
Yeah, and Diana, just FYI, we have about a dozen members of the public here in the Los Angeles site.
Great. Well, I hope they're more comfortable than we are. We have a rather small meeting room, and people are packed in, so I'm glad that they're, you have some company there, and I hope they're... you have such a gracious space. I'm sure they're more comfortable than we are.
Yeah, we have an open bar and chicken wings.
Fine, make people up here want to fly down to L.A., Bob. Great.
I'm coming there next time. Okay, we have one member still to arrive, but we are going to go ahead and get started. We did call the roll and ask for conflicts, as we do at the beginning of every meeting before we adjourn into closed session. I will again ask for any declarations of conflict, and there are none. Let me get to my right page. We have no minutes today from the last meeting. We will do minutes from the last meeting and this meeting at our regularly scheduled meeting, which I think is May 23rd. So I will, I think this is yours. We've changed the format of my script a little bit, so I apologize that I used to be able to tell the difference between what I was supposed to say and what Peter's supposed to say, but I'm turning it over to Peter now for the executive director's report.
Thank you, Diana. First, I want to thank the Fair Political Practices Commission. It is a cozy space, but on short notice, filling in and helping us do this is very appreciated, in particular the Chair, Ann Ravel, and the Interim Executive Director, Tina Bass, and it really is a cozy but comfortable space. We welcome you here. I know you'll all be disappointed. I am not doing PowerPoints today. Thank you. The crowd roars. There are a couple things. There are no specific reports from the closed session. We were talking about contracting and negotiating with the health plans. I want to do a couple updates, though, of what's happened since the last board meeting. First is we announced at the April 23rd board meeting and shared draft comments on proposed comments from Covered California on the federal navigator and non-navigator assistant rules. We submitted our comments yesterday. They are now posted online. And I want to note that in particular, we received very thoughtful comments with regard to issues of when it would be appropriate, if ever, for an in-person assister to refer someone elsewhere for language services or serving people with disabilities. We actually changed our comments to be silent on that issue. We think the issue of no wrong door principle is so important to affirm, and that while we want to make sure that people of different abilities, language, know where else they can get service, that a sister should help them if they don't want to go elsewhere. So it's one of the things we did not comment on in the comments we submitted yesterday. We thank people for their weighing in on our draft comments. Second, I wanted to update folks that if you have not seen it, April 30th, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services released a new single streamlined application for federally facilitated exchanges. We are in the process of looking at that new federal form. It has three distinct forms, a short form for an individual, a family form, and a short form for individuals who don't want financial assistance. As you all know, I think, state-based exchanges can use the federal application or design its own form. California is intent on designing our own application. We're reviewing the new federal applications to inform our development process. We will be providing a more detailed update at the May 23rd meeting. Having a application that is easy, clear, and simple is important. And we appreciate the work that many are doing to make sure that's the case on the application form we use. Next, before moving into the contract, I want to note reminders on what's coming up at the next meeting. There's going to be a couple issues for action at the next meeting, one of which is on the issues of agents and assisters. You're going to hear a presentation from Tian Lam today on the assisters program. We hope we get to it. But I want to note that we've already received comments from Health Access, CPEN, and Consumers Union with regard to our proposed policy on agents and assisters. Appreciate those comments. Comments are open until May 17th. We appreciate folks looking at that policy. We think we are balancing the issues of potential conflicts and steerage and being efficient with having everyone be on board with supporting enrollment. So that's going to be an action item at the next board meeting. The other is we've had at prior board meetings discussion of the Choosing Wisely initiative, which is an initiative co-sponsored by Consumers Union and the American Board of Internal Medicine to encourage better dialogue and discussion between patients and their clinicians about right care at the right time. We'll be bringing a proposal for Covered California to become a consumer partner with that initiative to promote it robustly. It will be an action item. It's already been discussed in broad terms before, and you'll get material on that before the meeting. With that, I am very happy to turn to the core of the agenda today, which is our model contract. And I want to note that this is a action item for the board. I want to start with a note of thanks in a number of fronts. First, to the staff of and consultants of Covered California, Andrea, Kathy, Brandon, Ken. I mean, we have really dozens of people who have been working, as many of you know, all hours of the day and night over the last not just week but months to create a contract that we believe will serve as a truly a model contract, a contract that will serve us well going forward but actually serve as an example for the nation. I also want to thank the our regulator, partners, DMHC, Department of Insurance, the health plans, consumers, providers that have weighed in actively, robustly, thoughtfully. We have, and you'll hear from Andrea in more detail, made a lot of changes since 2 weeks ago, and that product was the basis of a lot of concerted input in the months prior to develop a contract which we think serves as a very, very good platform going forward. Makes it very clear that Covered California is an active purchaser, and as that, we'll be working with health plans, but in partnership with others that, in the case of regulators, play their role as regulators. In the case of health plans, that are the entities that actually do the contracting and organize and coordinate the care, but with a common vision to addressing what our board has said is that triple aim, making sure people get the best care possible, stay as healthy as possible, and we lower costs together. We think this contract lays that out. I will note we have said, and the president has said, that we don't think this contract is perfect. We think it's really good. We will improve on it over time, and we do think it provides a very good roadmap and basis for our working together in the years to come. And we want to thank in particular the board for its direction at the last meeting, which helped us focus on some of the issues to have the contract identify where we wanted to go and make sure we're measuring how we're getting there and less specifically prescribing exactly how to get there. And I think the discussion we had at the last board meeting from the board really gave staff the ability to focus over the last 10 days. I think it's evidenced in the material before you. With that, I'd like to have Andrea join us to present the review of the process, how we got where we are, the major changes, and then we will ask for a resolution from the board before we have both public testimony and then discussion with the board. Andrea?
This is a little different. Quite know where the slides are going to read out of the back of my head. Madam Chair and Board, I'd like to talk a little bit very briefly about the where we've been.
Andrea, if it's more comfortable, you can turn to the side of the podium.
Like
well, I mean, just, yeah, turn it so that you're more comfortable.
So as you are well aware, we've been working on this now for several months, and that has entailed broad engagement with not only the plans, but also our many stakeholders, and they've been very clear about what they want to change and their input. This was premised on the August 2012 policies that you adopted, including the seven key active purchaser principles, and we seek to continue to reflect those principles in when we get down into the weeds of the model contract. April 1st, we revised our second draft. April 19th, it was further revised again on the 22nd, and there's even a date in here. We asked for comments on some specific provisions between the 26th and the 29th. So we've had a lot of back and forth. We have made revisions based on board direction. We've had several webinars, including some very specific ones on performance standards and HIPAA and privacy issues. So today we bring forth our final recommendation, and that was posted last night. A quick review of the timeline. Actually, I don't think I'm going to go through this item by item, but to note that we will be asking for your approval of the final model contract today, as Peter mentioned. And we will be hoping to do a little bit of cleanup, but that would be limited to just formatting and things like that. We're beginning to enter into our negotiation period with the qualified health plan bidders. We hope to emerge from that with an announcement on May 23rd. Of who those plans will be, at which point the plans will file their rates for reasonableness review with the regulators, and hopefully by the end of June, early July, we'll have final contracts signed and ready to be loaded into CalHERS. So these are the major issues that we did present, the issue areas, if you will, that we did present at your last board meeting. I don't think I'm going to go through them because I'd like to just kind of get right into the changes that we're recommending. If you have any questions on those areas, I'd be happy to take those. And importantly, we are providing a list of all the commenters who provided us comments after the 23rd board meeting. You can imagine we've been very busy reviewing these comments and figuring out the best way to respond. So here are some of the issues. Obviously not an exhaustive list of areas where we've made changes. We did spend a fair amount of time now getting into the weeds on clarifying legal terms throughout the contracts. What are the rights and responsibilities of the exchange, the details of indemnification, and, of course, the ever-present concern about the privacy of information and protecting that. We reorganized the delivery reform section in general for clarity and better flow, and I would say that's not only true of Attachment 7, but throughout the contract, we've moved paragraphs around to where things made more sense. We have maintained the requirements for cost and quality transparency, both at the plan and the provider level, and we know that's controversial, but we feel that laying the foundation for delivery system reform, that's an essential requirement. We've got to start getting the information that we need in order to move to specific delivery system reforms in 2015. On the issue of promoting delivery reform, we changed our approach, as Peter mentioned, to be less prescriptive and more let's sit down and figure out what works and how it works and how we're going to work on it together. And that involved also phasing in many of the data submission and reporting requirements. So you'll see that in Attachment 7, Section 1.01, and throughout. With respect to the issue of collecting health disparities data, we know that many of those data elements are not collected today, that many of them are sensitive items. We heard that loud and clear. And again, rather than taking a prescriptive approach and saying you shall collect these items, we have changed the wording to reflect an approach where we're going to sit down, exchange and plan, and figure out what is the most viable approach to not only collecting the data, but having programs to reduce health disparities. But we have not abandoned our position that data collection on health disparities is a foundational requirement to be able to develop effective programs. We have added the requirement for notice to providers of enrollees who have not made premium payments during the grace period. We'll just be right up front here. Is it conflict between state law and federal rules? And we're trying to dance on the head of a pin in that respect. We need to acknowledge the federal rule and the very appropriate concerns of providers during months two and months three that their claims may be pended. Pended doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be denied, but we believe that they do deserve notice when an enrollee is in that month two and month three. So we've tried to strike a balance there. We have added a requirement that in absence of state law, issuers will agree to terminate their current plans, many of which will not be ACA compliant, by the way, all of which will not be compliant with the ACA as of 12/31/13. And this is for the public policy goal of creating a level playing field between the new plans that will be sold not only by the exchange, but also outside of the exchange, that for a brief period, could be up to a year, will be in competition with arguably inferior plans that are not compliant with the Affordable Care Act. This is voluntary on the part of our issuers. We have clarified the shop participation fee at $18.90 PMPM. That was not in the last contract. And we have added, even though we're not asking you to vote on the performance penalties and credits at this meeting, that is deferred. I want to be really clear about that all of the performance penalties and credits are being deferred to decision by you at the April 23rd board meeting. We do want to call out that we have added performance penalties and credits for Covered California, where we are taking on standards and holding ourselves accountable for those standards that if we fail to reach those standards could potentially allow the QHPs to earn credits. One more point that I didn't include on my slide that I do want to call out. We did put in a new paragraph. I believe it's 2.03 that is with respect to protecting the confidentiality of certain communications that are provided by the plans to us. We do believe that we made that a little bit too overbroad, and we will be looking at refining the language on that to really get at what we were concerned about, which was protecting the confidential communications with our plans, but not inappropriately excluding documents that should be available to the public. So a few decisions that have been made regarding benefit plan designs, and we did put this out to the general public on April 26th, and even prior was mentioned at the last board meeting, that we have taken action on, and just internally, we have decided that we're not going to be offering any silver health savings account in 2014 in the individual market only. And the policy reasons for that are we determined that it confounded our lowest and our second lowest silver, which, as all of you know, is critical for the calculation of the advanced premium tax credit. And it was just too confusing and too troubling when we knew that many of the enrollees who would be buying this silver would not be interested in a health savings account. We and the feds have both figured out that there really is no ability to offer the silver plan variation for the cost reduction plans using an HSA silver. And so that is actually a problem that has not been resolved. And we are aware that the federal officials know that's a problem. They have to. They are not able to solve it as well. Health savings, I just I want to emphasize, since when you went back and you did adopt the standard benefit plan designs, some people have asked us, well, the silver HSA plans were part of what you adopted as a standard benefit plan design. How can you just drop it now? And the reason we did that and we recommended that is that so that if we had silver HSA benefit plans, they were standardized. There was no requirement in the QHP solicitation whatsoever that a bidder propose a silver. That was a silver HSA or a bronze HSA. That was entirely optional. So I just wanted to clarify that even though we included it in that package, it was never a bidding requirement. Similarly, we're not going to be accepting any of the alternate benefit plan designs for the individual exchange. Again, similar to the HSA, they were not a bidding requirement. It was entirely an optional choice. After we studied them quite carefully and with our actuary, we determined that they would be confusing to the consumer when the benefits and the actuarial values were basically the same. It would be very hard for people to figure out what's the advantage and the disadvantage of one of our standard plans versus an alternate. Many that were submitted were similar to the standard plan designs with very minor changes. However, the shop is a different matter, and we're going to reserve the right to be very selective, but to possibly include alternate benefit plan designs in the shop. And we all know the plans can still offer whatever they want as long as it meets regulatory requirements outside the exchange. And we will be watching that market carefully during 2014. And so with that, I'll be happy to take questions.
Are there questions from the board? For Andrea, I know Peter, do you want to add something?
Let me add a few things first.
Yeah.
One, thank you to Andrea and the team that did a huge amount of work. The board is going to be asked to adopt a resolution that in many ways acknowledges that this is a living document. Not that we will be changing it willy-nilly, but that it would give staff the ability to make minor changes to affect its purpose. An example that Andrea noted is we will hold confidential what should be confidential, but if there's material that's public material, that's not confidential. So we need to clarify language like that. There's some other examples like that. The other example of it being a living document is we have sought again and again to be mindful of burden on both plans and on providers. An example of that is to have requirements on HEDIS reporting to be based on what plans do at the commercial level. We are part of the commercial marketplace. Currently, NCQA's plan requirements are to have accredited plans report separately HEDIS for exchange versus the commercial market. If that is what is part of standard accreditation, we would accept that reporting. And that's examples of we need to be, as a market, nimble if in terms of the spirit that we're offering the contract in. And again, this is an issue that while it is the current proposal of NCQA to do that, it is still in play and discussion nationally with regard to HEDIS. There's no discussion, I don't think, about the CAHPS reporting being exchange specific, but does it make sense to do HEDIS reporting at exchange versus commercial, I think is still in play. The other thing I want to underscore is it is absolutely the intent that this model contract serve for the vast majority of terms to be applied in the same manner to all plans. We would, however, have some plan-specific addenda that would be very specific and used in an exceptional basis to address plan-specific issues. We think it's important that we have the ability to negotiate those, and we would do those very much as the exception rather than the rule, and the resolution for the board acknowledges that ability that we would have. Finally, the resolution before the board notes that we are seeking adoption, as Andrea noted, of the model contract as proposed with all of the attachments, with the exception of Attachment 14. Attachment 14 is the section on performance standards. We are moving quickly. We feel good about what is there. We wanted to allow people to have a chance to look at it. And it is important. As Andrea noted, it notes standards to which we would be held. Because planned success include our answering the phone, include our service center functioning well, includes our providing information to the plans as well as the plans performing well. So we added a whole section on credits for our performance, but also trying to develop and identify standards that are benchmark standards in the industry in terms of the standards to which we would hold plans. We will be coming back at the May 23rd meeting with the performance standards. With that, we welcome questions, discussions from the board, which they may want to do after a board motion.
And I would ask for a motion. The resolution's included in the material. The board hereby resolves that in accordance with specified government code sections, the executive director or his authorized designee be authorized to finalize and execute the 2013-2014 Qualified Health Plan Model Contract, which includes all the attachments thereto with the exception of Attachment 14. The executive director or his authorized designee shall have the authority to make revisions to the model contract necessary to effectuate the board's policy decisions and on as-needed basis and on as-needed limited basis to execute plan-specific addenda to the model contract. Do I have a motion for that resolution?
So moved.
Thank you, Bob. Second? Thank you, Paul. Now, any questions from the board of Andrea or Peter or other staff before we open up for public comment? Go
Madam
ahead,
Chair.
Bob. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of comments and then one specific question. Number one, I know it's too early to celebrate anything because we haven't taken the vote yet, but I really do want to once again thank Peter and his team for being active listeners and engagers. There's a lot of changes from the first cut draft. It shows good attentive listening by our team at Covered California, and I think practical and pragmatic listening and engagement. And then equally, the input that and engagement we had both from plan representatives, providers, as well as consumers and consumer groups. It just, I know it may not have always felt or looked this pretty, Peter, but the impression I get is folks really trying to make this a good product and trying to make this thing of ours work. And I feel really quite appreciative of all of the late hours and long hours that folks have put into to get this this model contract tweaked and modified and dressed up. So again, thanks all around, and I'm feeling really very appreciative of all the work that's going into it. I'll wait to hear more in the public commentary, but there was one particular area, Peter, and I can't find the exact section now in my red line document, but it had to do with the language regarding there seemed to be a broad protection asked for by the plans, apparently, that every document or any document provided by an issuer to the exchange should be deemed confidential. And that particular language struck me and also some consumer groups as being a bit too broad and over the top. And I'm sure that even if in the case that that such information is required by other existing law or statute, we would the plans or we would not be exempted from that. So I wonder if you could just address that particular issue.
Yeah, I'd be more than happy. This is section 2.03 on exchange confidentiality responsibility. And I think that it's the comments are well taken. We're moving quickly. The plans are rightfully concerned. We asked for a number of materials, such as their marketing plans, which they hold close. It's proprietary. We want to be clear. We will, and we have a legal ability to hold that confidential, from Public Record Act requests, under our government code. But the current way it's stated, it says all documents and information provided, some of the material provided is public, is going to be non-confidential, non-private. We don't want to say that, for instance, a evidence of coverage would be held as confidential. So this is an example of what I noted of the board's authorization to have modifications to this before we execute the contract. I want to note that, as Andrea noted our timeline, we look forward on May 23rd. We hope to be announcing tentative certification of plans, and they will be submitting their rates for regulatory review. We will not be signing the contracts on that moment. We'll be signing the contract at the end of that process around July 1. So we can do micro changes. I think this is an example where we need to have a change that it's all documents and information that, you know, should be reasonably held confidential or some such lawyerly language that doesn't be over prescriptive. So I think that's a part of the reason we think we need a little bit of elbow room to do micro changes.
Thank you, Peter. Kim, did you have something? Okay. We will open it now for public comment, and I would remind the callers that you can dial *1 to get in the queue. I will be notified when there is a queue on the phone, and I will get to it in relationship to the number of people who are standing in the room asking to speak. So, Beth, start us off. Good morning.
Beth Capel for Health Access California. We too think this is a much improved document that makes clear that the contract will evolve over time and that the active purchaser role will evolve over time. We very much appreciate the exclusion of health savings accounts from the silver plans and also the disinclination to accept alternative benefit designs. We think standardization is one of the very good things you have done. We also appreciate the contracts including coordination with other programs so that we can have wraparound affordability and think that's a very good step forward. We appreciate your attention to that language on confidentiality and your clarity that you will make that a little narrower. One question we would note, in the presentation and also the slideshow, it said that contracting issuers are prohibited from offering non-grandfathered plans outside the exchange after December 31st. However, we note the contract refers to March 31st. And so we just raised that. We also raised a concern that non-contracting issuers would not be bound by this, and we do have a concern about the market implications. Again, we are appreciative of the transition plan for moving subsidy-eligible people into the exchange who are current enrollees or future enrollees. One question we would have in the document now where you discuss, in the attachment 7, where you discuss at-risk enrollees, you list diabetes, asthma, hypertension, and heart disease as serious chronic conditions. We would note that depression is as prevalent and comorbid with those conditions and undermines their management. So we will look forward to working with you in the future on rate review. We will again note the law says 60 days. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Beth. And we will take the questions and answer them at the end. Thank you.
Good morning. Betsy Umholtz from Consumers Union. I as well wanted to commend the staff for a really great job in listening hard to the many, many comments that we gave and, while not accepting every single one, adopting many of them. And we really think that this version of the model contract goes a long way to holding true to the triple aim and reaching that goal of wellness and health improvement, a goal of Covered California, while adopting a phased approach and not being overly prescriptive as we start out, all of us, in this new world to figure out what we really need to do. I would just adopt Ms. Capel's comments. She said just about everything I was going to say. The couple things I would add is also a commendation for holding true to that provider contracting language requiring that plans disclose to the exchange the provider contract costs. I think that's really important as you try to figure out for consumers and for yourselves what is a good value plan, that be there. And I see also that there's some nice language in attempting to at least start to get that information out to consumers. Very, very important stuff. Two things additional. We look forward to working with the exchange on the demographic data and other data you'll be collecting. I know Ms. Rosen referred to the plans in the exchange. We want to be part of that conversation. Very important stuff. And finally, on the confidentiality rules, we really look forward to that sort of loosening. It did seem overly broad to us. Where marketing plans, for example, may be obviously a proprietary concern, marketing materials that are actually going out to the public anyway, it seems to us, needn't be. So that's just one example. We look forward to working with you further on it. Thank
Great.
You.
Thank you, Betsy.
Howdy. Michael Weinberg, Barrier Council. Congratulations. A quick question and then a conditional comment. The question is whether or not the prohibition of offering non-ACA compliant plans applies to also the small group market as well as the individual market. If it does apply to the small group market as well as the individual market, I think that creates a lot more concerns about the market dynamics. On the individual side, obviously, the exchange has the subsidies, and so it's got that muscle. There's no real muscle. for the small group side. So you'd really be putting the participating plans at a major disadvantage on the small group side if that prohibition also applied to small group. If it doesn't, great. If it does, then I echo Beth's concerns.
Thank you. And your conditional comment, Micah?
Well, that was it.
Got it. Thanks. Hi, Charles.
Charles Blackaby with the California Association of Health Plans. Again, thank you to you and all of your staff for working tirelessly over the last few weeks to improve this contract. It's come a long way since it was initially released. Last board meeting, we asked the board to consider engaging in a meaningful discussion between CAP and our member plans to resolve the outstanding differences in the contract. And we even signed a joint letter with providers asking for additional stakeholder meeting. We did have a webinar. But something positive did develop, which was that Covered California, I think, redoubled its efforts to talk confidentially with its bidders about the terms of this contract and also acknowledged that there were some specific sections of this contract that needed work. Now, CAP was not, nor can we be, part of any confidential discussions between any of the bidders and Covered California. So obviously we reviewed the contract last night like many others and tried to figure out what it all meant. There's not a lot of changes since the last version, which can tell you that those confidential discussions had those results. And we really leave ourselves asking the question, how much of a model contract is a model contract and what's the definition of one? We believe that plans will be seeking additional changes during the contracting process. It's unclear that the HIPAA and the intellectual properties provisions were clarified. Attachment 14 is still up for vote next board meeting, and as discussed robustly, there are confidentiality concerns about the terms of the contract. And finally, as staff has noted, the resolution authorizes staff to make changes between now and the execution of this contract, including plan-specific addendums. And while we think this is a good thing, because there are substantial differences between each plan and its model, we just note that this contract is clearly going to be undergoing some changes in the coming weeks. And again, thank you and your staff. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Charles.
Hi, Carrie Sanders with the California Pan-Ethnic Health Network. Seconding comments of Beth Capel and Betsy Imholtz, but wanted to start by thanking the exchange for also for the hard work and the back and forth, the conversations about how to make the model contract a stronger model contract. We didn't get everything we wanted, but what we did get, I think, does really move us forward in the conversation about how we can all partner together to eliminate health disparities in our state. There are some questions open about how health plans will partner with Covered California and vice versa to collect demographic data on all of the categories that are covered under the non-discrimination provisions of the Affordable Care Act. And we look forward to participating with you all in these conversations moving forward, you know, on making clear what current obligations are with respect to, you know, the collection of this data, while also, you know, thinking, brainstorming together about how we can improve on the current practices to come up with best practices. Thanks.
Thanks, Carrie.
Bill Worley, Kaiser Permanente. You're probably tired of people thanking you, but
I'm
thank
not.
You. Why did I guess that? Thank you to Peter and Kathleen and Andrea for the work that's gone on in the last couple of weeks. So we think it's in pretty good shape. There are a couple of areas that we just wanted to highlight. In the privacy sections, we think we have conceptual agreement at the staff level, still some wordsmithing, a couple of places where we need to make sure the words reflect what we think at least is a conceptual agreement. And then lastly, and maybe you're going to hear this from others, you will certainly hear from us, the contract suggests that our contracts with providers will be amended, and I think the verbiage is something like as mutually agreeable between us and the exchange. And that's a laudable aim, but there's a third party, which is the provider, that has to agree to that. And so we just, I don't know that there's any further change that can happen to the language, but just as a highlight, we may be coming to the staff between now and July saying we could not get agreement, and so we're not going to be able to change that. And I mentioned that in our case because the language also applies to subcontractors as well as to our integrated providers. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Jeff Shelton on behalf of HealthNet. Thank you, thank you, thank you. we concur with what Mr. Worley said about providers. They are an important third party. There are many third parties between the exchange and the contractors. Some things the providers will probably agree to pretty quickly. Other things they'll agree to in sometime in the future, and some things they will not agree to. So it's a caution to you and a caution to all of us as we try to work through this process to improve the delivery of healthcare. Regarding privacy, I understand but have not seen that there may be additional language regarding data at risk. It is an important issue to us. We do encrypt data at rest, but not all our providers do. And to do that for them, it can't be done quickly, and it is expensive. Regarding confidentiality, our concerns are different than what has been uttered by other people. Our attorneys are not completely convinced that you have the authority to keep this information confidential. And we've looked at the code sections that have been referenced in the contract, and we don't see that authority there. So we're going to need to continue to do some work with you because we want to get it really right to make sure that we keep confidential what needs to be and provide to the public what they should see. Finally, regarding over carryover IFP products, it was talked about by Ms. Capel. We agree with her. We think that the board should sponsor legislation to apply this provision that you've added to the contract in and outside the marketplace. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Hi, Ruth Liu, Blue Shield of California. Again, I will say thank you, thank you, thank you to specifically to Andrea Rosen, Peter Lee, Kathleen. I know you guys have been working very, very hard and listening to a lot of our concerns. That contract has gotten much, much better. We still, like Kaiser and HealthNet, have the similar concerns around the protection of health information. We think it's almost where it needs to be, but not quite there. Confidentiality of information as well. We have similar concerns. The contracting issues, we agree completely with what Kaiser and HealthNet have said, so we want to tell you that as well, that there's certain things we can do and certain things that we might not be able to do with our partners. One thing that I will raise that is a little different is for the branding issues that are raised with the co-branding. We certainly would like to comply with the exchange's co-branding, but we also have BCBSA association rules that we have to comply with. So we need to ensure that we can meet both of our parties' needs on that. So we very much appreciate what has gone forward, but there are some changes that still likely need to be made in further discussions with the exchange and the staff. So thank you.
Thanks, Ruth.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Deborah Kelch with the Kelch Policy Group and the Health Insurance Alignment Project. We'd also like to acknowledge the heavy lift of staff and the board and others involved in this final contract. The final model contract, however, before you today, continues to have language that we think is confusing as to the respective roles of the exchange and the two state regulators, Department of Managed Healthcare and Department of Insurance. The contract says that the exchange will determine whether issuers are licensed and in good standing with the regulators and whether they have any material violations that would disqualify them from participating in the exchange. It would be unusual for a purchaser to make such a determination and unclear on what basis they could do so. We believe it rather makes sense that the exchange look to DMHC and CDI for an assessment of good standing for potential issuers. At this point, since the changes were not made, we believe it is very important for the board to get clarification and information on how the exchange will make any determination of the regulatory standing of issuers and what coordination there will be with DMHC and CDI. Finally, we would respectfully caution that an informal statement from staff that they will rely on the regulators would not fully mitigate the legal contract language that would otherwise be in the public domain without further clarification. Thank you.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you. Ann Iowan with the Association of California Life and Health Insurance Companies. Our trade association represents many of the same companies that CAP has, only on the PPO side of the business. To that end, we joined in that joint letter asking for more dialogue. In terms of the model contract, we're very pleased with many of the changes that have been made, so I waited till now to say thank you, just to be different. But we do want to also thank you for some of the changes that were made, particularly with relationship to PPO products and how that would work with those kind of network changes. So that particularly we thank you. We would like you to consider all the concerns related to privacy and provider contracting that have been raised by our members here. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for your comments.
I'm just looking at the timer, sorry. Janice Rocco,
Department
of Insurance. We agree with the statements by Deborah Kelch. Our understanding of the role that we'd be playing as the regulator would be to notify you about a carrier's situation in terms of licensure and whether they're in good standing with their regulator. And the way that the contract language reads, it looks like you would be making a determination about accuracy of what we're notifying you about. So that probably still needs some work. Two other issues. When it comes to the decision to have insurers terminate their current plans effective December 31st of this year, the stated reason for requiring this is that you want a level playing field. But by doing this in the absence of state law that would apply the same standard outside the exchange, you do exactly the opposite of creating a level playing field. You have some carriers who will be doing it and other carriers who won't be doing it. So you may want to reconsider that before you vote. And the last issue that I wanted to raise today is having to do with the alternative plan designs. We understood in the past there was discussion about the essential health benefits and whether that should be the floor and the ceiling for benefits. Apparently, the staff recommendation is that, yes, it will be both the floor and the ceiling. That may create a situation where people who do not have who are not subsidy eligible will go outside the exchange for their coverage because they will want something additional. Our department would recommend to you instead that you trust that folks who are in the exchange could make the decision between the alternate design and the standard design in terms of what's best for them so that you don't have a lot of folks shopping outside the exchange because they want a particular benefit like chiropractic care. Thank you.
Thanks, Janice.
Hi, Kate Birch with the California LGBT Health and Human Services Network, and I noticed in the contract that the definition of family is still the federal definition, which does not include same-sex partners, domestic partners, same-sex spouses, and usually also not the children of same-sex spouses. And also, in the area where it talks about who can get coverage through SHOP, it says that employees and employee family members using that definition of family are eligible for coverage. So that makes it seem, from my reading, as if same-sex couples will not be able to get coverage through their employer if their employer is going through the SHOP program, which does not create a level playing field and also seems to violate California law.
Thank you for your comments.
Good morning. Elizabeth Landsberg with the Western Center on Law and Poverty, and just want to concur with all of my consumer advocate colleagues and their comments thus far, including Ms. Birch's comments, and want to add our thanks on a few particular issues, including not allowing HSA plans in the silver tier, which we were very concerned would undermine the value of the advanced premium tax credit. Also, your disinclination to allow alternative benefit plans, and the language about coordinating with other programs, which will be particularly important depending on where we end up on pregnancy, Medi-Cal, and some of the immigrant populations. Thank you.
Thanks, Elizabeth. We have one caller. Operator, if you'd open the line, please.
Abigail Corsell for National Health Law. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and thank you to the board and to the staff for all of your hard work, echoing the comments of many before me. We've seen a lot of important changes here. We would like to echo the comments of Ms. Birch, Ms. Landsberg, Ms. Capel, Ms. Imholtz, and Ms. Sanders. And I just want to add one additional point, specifically looking at the language on coordination between programs. We really appreciate the additions to Section 106, Subsection 2, to clarify the role of QHPs here. And we realize, as Ms. Landsberg said, this is an area that's still very much in flux. We don't know exactly what some of these programs will look like in 2014, but we very much appreciate the recognition that QHPs are a partner in making sure that these programs are coordinated, and the commitment to ensuring that everyone gets the most comprehensive and affordable care possible. Just a word about pregnant women in particular. We're particularly concerned about women who have high-risk pregnancies, We want to make sure that this contract engages QHPs to ensure that they get the full range of services at the lowest cost possible to ensure the best possible outcomes both for mothers and for babies. And we look forward to continuing to work with the exchange on this issue. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you all for your comments. We'll open it back up to the board for questions and comments following. Yes, Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, the open bar trick didn't work. I do have one speaker here.
Oh, there you go.
That's great.
Let's take your speaker, Bob. Please identify yourself.
Hi, this is Francine from Anthem, California.
Thank you, Francine. Go ahead.
Hi. It's kind of weird being in a room with like 15 people. But Anthem chimes in with everybody with respect to thank you for the staff's work on the model contract. We know Cover California is seeking to balance many objectives to live up to the mission statement. However, we respectfully comment that there are a few new requirements, some with sizable performance penalties on the qualified health plans in this new marketplace with no known or established baseline that will be costly, increased staffing, performance penalties, and reporting, and or the ability to meet the requirements is dependent on other parties or factors, such as provider contracts and pended claims. Anthem respects the ambitious goals of Cover California, but concerns remain that this contract has elements that will subject the QHP to an inability to perform to the highest standards both Cover California and Anthem would desire. We look forward to continue our dialogue with Cover California to find the balance necessary for all stakeholders. Thanks.
Thank you.
And one more speaker, I'm sorry.
Sure. Thanks. All right. Thanks, Bob.
Good morning. Thank you. This is Marie Lopez, Vision and Compromiso. Also want to thank the board for all your hard work and reaching this decision. Wanted to support the comments of Beth Capel, Angela Lansbury. I'm sorry, Elizabeth Lansbury. Angela Lansbury is an actress. Carrie Sanders, and particularly underscore the comments of Carrie Sanders and the importance of data collection. If we are to reduce health disparities, this is going to be a key element. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Anything else, Bob?
No, the troops here are now quiet and settled.
Great. Thank you. Peter, I'm going to ask you to answer and respond to the questions and comments and include it in that list, if you would, please. The sense of the extent to which you are asking us to allow for amendment. I want to be clear as the chair that I see this as a model contract that may be as much as 95% or more set, that the modifications are going to be minor and in furtherance to our policies, as is said in the resolution. But I'd like you to speak to the extent to which you think we are granting you authority for changes.
Great. Thank you. First, I want to appreciate both all the comments made, and I'll share the thanks with all of you. I was last week in Washington at, among other things, a conference on exchanges. Many exchanges out there are not active purchasers. We are an exception to that rule, and this contract lays out a path of being truly an active purchaser, both in how we select plans, but also in how we partner with plans to change the delivery system. And I think that it's embodied in many places in this contract. That's a global note. I'm going to actually try to tick off and respond to specific issues raised. First, the red line you got was not a perfect red line, so I'd encourage people to look at the clean version. So to the issue of 304B, offerings outside the exchange, the clean version says December 31st, 2013. We agree strongly that a level playing field would not have a difference between what is inside and outside Covered California's market. Covered California is prescribed from lobbying. We don't lobby. We provide technical assistance to legislators and others. We think there ought to be a law. Enough said. Not quite. I don't need to talk coy, but this really is an issue that's of great import. And having, in the absence of there being a law, we think it is important for a number of policy reasons and for consumers to have the benefit of the protections of the Affordable Care Act, and that the entire risk pool is a better risk pool than having been screened out by having the potential of individual products carrying across into 2014. I would note that the language in 304B is specific to the individual health insurance market. Second, I'd go to a number of really very thoughtful comments with regard to how we are approaching the issues of changing the delivery system, including issues such as how do we define at-risk populations, issues of how do we define, for example, the collection of when people have been either selected or assigned to a primary care provider. Those are issues we look forward to working not just with health plans, but with consumer advocates, providers, and others. And I want to call out to the public Article 1.01 in terms of the requirement on plans to cooperate and work with us on a range of issues is not a behind-closed-door cooperation. It's doing that through requiring the contractors that we end up engaging with to participate in the exchanges, advisory and planning processes, not limited to participating in the Plan Management Delivery System Reform Advisory Group, which we are very happy to note the mix of people on there, including clinicians, consumer advocates, agents, others. But that's going to be a forum we're going to have a lot of ongoing work on, including issues of fleshing out measurement issues, et cetera. We wrestle with issues. Do we define and cast into the contract right now on a go-forward basis how to concretize at risk? We think we need to work on that. And that's going to be an ongoing process that in that setting and others will be working on those sorts of issues. But I do want to underscore that coordination and cooperation will be with plans and with others. And so look to Section 1.01. A number of people made comments about the privacy language. And this is an example where, Madam Chair, the resolution authorizes revisions before the contract is finalized. We want to make sure we get this right, making sure the privacy of individuals' information that we want and need to use to understand what's happening to meet the triple aim is vital. And so that's a legal issue. Getting those the issues of HIPAA right are complex. We're moving quickly. We might need to change words here or there to address that intent of making sure we are absolutely making sure that the privacy and confidentiality of material is maintained. So we appreciate those comments. Some of the comments went to issues of, I'll give the example of branding. We noted that it's important that the branding of Covered California is important. We have contractual requirements here that would have our logo on a number of specific material and also working with plans to potentially be on other material. We recognize in the case of some plans we might contract with, they may have requirements related to their associations. That actually might be an example of where we would have a specific addenda for a particular plan. But that's an example that would call out where we might have a variation, which to your question, Madam Chair, the ability to have limited plan-specific addenda, to my mind, isn't a 5% issue. It's a 1% issue, is that the model contract really should be 99% applying to all plans on an equal and consistent basis. And the exceptions to that on an addenda basis would be very focused, very limited, which is why we, again, will have some other polishing in the days to come with the board saying, you've got it right, but make sure you address privacy and other issues well in terms of some of the very specific language. With regard to the issue of good standing, I want to note that we've had extensive discussions with the Department of Managed Health Care. I was actually I heard from Department of Insurance some questions and concerns. We've been working arm in arm with the regulators in terms of listening to them, looking at what they do to guide what would be a potential violations of their regulatory processes that would relate to a material violation. We believe that as part of the Affordable Care Act that we look at good standing and the regulator looks at licensure, and that good standing in terms of what is material, we recognize is not a absolute crystal clear line. We would look to the regulators to guide us in terms of whether in the penalties levied, violations of a plan that is licensed to provide us guidance that we would bring to the board. So those are a trying to set up and knock down, so to speak, the major concerns. We will look at the other issue was definition of family. By definition, we will not have plans in violation of state law. So we'll look at that term specifically. And again, this is has been and will continue to be a fruitful discussion as we go forward.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions. It doesn't look like there's a question on anybody's face here. Bob, do you have a question before I take the roll call on this measure? Kim?
I have a very brief comment. Great. after we take the vote, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Kim does have a comment. Your microphone.
Very brief comment, and I really appreciate, Danny, your question about kind of what's the running room, and I think that's an important question really for all of us. And so, Peter, I really applaud and want to underscore your characterization of the 99% as we've discussed and consistent with our principles and values. You know, a common contract that is used by all the plans in our negotiations is really important to ensuring transparency and ensuring consistency and accountability and providing our consumers with the ability to make informed decision making. So I really want to underscore your point about the 99%, and basically what you see is what you get, recognizing there may need to be some very modest plan specific tweaks. So And I know all of the board members are very, very grateful to you and Andrea and Kathy and others who have dedicated a lot of time along with all of the many plan partners and consumer advocates and others. So good work.
Great. Thank you, Kim. So we'll take our roll call vote on the board resolution 2013-28. Belshe?
Aye.
Fearer?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Kennedy has had to leave a little early. The chair is aye. 4-0. Bob, to your comment.
Yeah, and again, this is for future reference, although the issue has come up at this meeting and at the most recent meeting as well. But I've been respectful and mindful of the health plan's suggestion that we just try and get our exchange up and running and open for business, and then begin to attend, focus more attention on issues of data collection and triple aim and disparity. So I look forward to when we can have a really good conversation with the plans about that, Peter. And I just again, my suggestion is just a thought. I would like to see something welcome some proactive thinking from the plans, and I'm not sure yet at the right moment when we have our qualified plan partners announced, and I'm not sure the mechanics of how to do this, but the health plans do have a substantial amount of experience around issues of data collection and triple aim and addressing the issue of disparities. This is not a new topic for this state and for the health plans in this state, and I would welcome some proactive strategic thinking in a dialogue with our board at the exchange about how they view the opportunities to utilize Covered California as a mechanism to address health disparities, to promote AAA movement, and become a more proactive force around the health of Californians. So I just want to put a placeholder in for that conversation, and I'm okay with backing off of our demands and requirements on that front at this point, but I just want to make sure that we save a date for that conversation in the near future.
Thank you, Bob. Peter.
Thank you all very much. And again, I want to thank the hundreds that have weighed in to make this, I think, a very good starting point for what are going to be an ongoing relationship between Covered California and plans, but involving many others to do just what Dr. Ross is noting, which is to not only expand coverage dramatically for millions of Californians, but also to address underlying the issues of providing high-quality care, promoting health, and addressing costs. With that, I'm very happy to turn to Tien Lam. Tien is our Deputy Director for Eligibility Enrollment, to give an update on our Assisters program. Again, we've been talking a lot in the last few meetings on health plan contracting selection issues. We know that our success at Covered California will hinge on three things. First, having affordable products, which the contract provides a platform for. Second is effective marketing and outreach. But the third is enrolling people, is getting people enrolled. I noted there's the new federal draft single application. We're working on that. We believe that many, many Californians will need human help. Key to that help will be the Assisters Program, and Tian's going to give us an update on some of those issues. This is not an item for action at this meeting, though it will be at the next board meeting or in June.
We will be aiming for next board meeting.
As I said, the next board meeting, which is tomorrow. No, it is May 23rd, so we'll be back on track there. Tian, please.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Lee, and recognizing that we've gone a little bit over time, I will quickly go through this because the intent is to primarily obtain the board's reaction as well as stakeholder feedback. And some of this information is familiar because it's been in the board presentation materials for a couple of times, and I'm very happy to be here to officially present. So just very quickly, the Assisters Program overview. Here is the guiding principles that were adopted by the board going back to last summer when we were moving forward with our outreach, education, and marketing work plan. And this was an item that was adopted and dated with the work plan June 26, to be precise. So, again, things that are very familiar to the board, maximizing enrollment, build on and leverage existing resources, consider where eligible populations live, work, and play, and also ensuring that the Assisters Program reflects the mix and diversity of our targeted populations. Here for the key components to success, Mr. Lee stole my speaking points. And so I won't go over this too much, but clearly Assisters Program is a true reflection of the third key component, which is ensuring a smooth enrollment into covered California products. Here is a list of eligible Assisters Program. Going back to the June 26 work plan, we had originally made six recommendations of different organizational types. This chart depicts the additional 14 organizations that staff has recommended. A lot of this has been vetted out with stakeholder feedback, and we've, since this list has been identified, have received very minimal stakeholder feedback informing us that we've missed a particular organizational type or not. Also, in the last column, it identifies organizations that would be eligible for compensation or not. And just to call out to the board that while agents will not be compensated by Covered California, they will be compensated through their plan relationships through the issuers. And this is just a continuation of that. So the Assisters Program, primarily comprises of two types of programs. Ooh, sorry about that. One of them is the in-person assistance program, which is basically the program that was identified in the federal blueprint that was released May of last year, giving state-based exchanges the opportunity to implement from an optional perspective an in-person assistance program. And then the Navigator program is the program that is denoted in the federal regulations, which are required by all exchanges. And here is just a depiction of the similarities of the Navigator program. In the federal blueprint, the feds made it very explicit and clear that if states elect an in-person assistance program, that it has to be slightly unique and distinctive compared to the Navigator program. And so in this particular case, then the in-person assistance program, assisters would not be conducting education activities, which is spearheaded by our outreach and education grantees, but will be performing services to help facilitate enrollment into Covered California. And both programs, I know it's sometimes confusing, is collectively referred to as our Global Assisters Program. And here is just an additional slide deck which shows the differences. The in-person assistance program is funded through our Level 2 grant, 100%, and the Navigator program is funded through our operational costs, basically our health plan fees that we collect. And the compensation modeling and the payment method are slightly different. For the in-person assistance program, it is based off of a flat fee payment for successful enrollment as well as annual renewals. And for the Navigator program, it's based off of a grant-based type of application. And the implementation timeline is a little bit different.
our in-person assistance program will be occurring right when open enrollment hits. And then for the Navigator program, it's occurring in the later part of the year because we have to collect the health plan fees in order to fund the Navigator program. This slide deck identifies the various triggering events that would result in payment for successful enrollment into Cover California for the initial application process as well as an annual redetermination process. Much of this has been shared and vetted with stakeholders, and we did not receive any type of additional feedback in regards to these payment triggers and when an in-person assister would be eligible to receive compensation, which results in the effectuation of coverage of consumers enrolled in our program. And the assisters program, key issues, assister liability insurance requirements, assister recruitment strategies, as well as the assisters training, just some key policy issues that we'd like to share with the board. And then in later slide decks, we'll be presenting our state draft regulations as well. And just to share, these are the various stakeholder feedback that we've received. We actually facilitated a webinar in February. We had 800 people registered, facilitated another webinar in mid-March. Over 500 people participated, as well as another webinar last week in which close to 600 individuals registered. So the assister insurance liability requirements, we originally were making recommendations to require assister enrollment entities to have both general liability and errors and omissions. And this actually resulted in some confusions with the stakeholders where they were under the impression that we would require individual assisters, employees who work for an organization to actually secure and obtain these liability insurance requirement. And so we just wanted to clarify that our intent was, in fact, intended for the organization to secure the liability. We also are continuing to recommend that the organization would also obtain liability for errors and omission types of insurance so long as federal guidance or federal regulations permit us to do so. And as of right now, there are some proposed federal regulations that still have not been solidified where it may appear that the federal regulations may not permit us to require the errors and omissions. Assisters recruitment strategy, we received very little feedback here, but basically a variety of the different stakeholders said, make sure you work with your plans and make sure you target organizations who have had existing experience serving similar populations. And so this following slide deck identifies some preliminary strategies that we've identified starting from the early recruitment in first quarter where we've started to collect information from various types of organizations who have expressed interest in becoming an assister enrollment entity. And then in our second quarter and our third quarter, second quarter will be primarily, you know, working with our partners in order to reach out to a variety of different organizations, and more targeted outreach will occur during the third quarter when we've been able to conduct a gap analysis to hone in on particular areas that need to have assister network capacity and representation. Assisters training. So we are recommending to provide a 2 to 3 day training session. It will be available whether through an in-person or instructor-led format or would be self-guided through a computer-based tutorial similar to some modeling that has been in the past facilitated by the Managed Risk Medical Insurance Board for their enrollment entity and certified application assistance program. The curriculum at this time, we've identified 10 key topic areas, which are denoted here, ranging from the Affordable Care Act, assister roles and responsibilities, compliance, eligibility information, and information clearly about our CalHEARS online application system. And folks will be able to determine or decide whether or not they preferred an instructor-led format or a computer-based tutorial. And we did receive feedback from stakeholders indicating that they felt that 2 to 3 days may not be enough. And again, that's feedback that we are looking at. We're taking also into consideration some particular curriculum objectives that were identified that were not originally included in our webinar slides. And then many stakeholders suggested that we would do a train-the-trainer
program, and we felt that we should probably delay that for a year or two because it's very critical for us to roll out with a consistent training program in order to ensure that standardization and quality of our assisters network capacity is out there for our consumer to support the guiding principles that I had walked through just a few slides ago. But something we would consider for year two. And now moving forward to our proposed state regulations. Here are items in which we guided our work in regards to our state regulations. This slide deck identifies the content contained and its sections of our state assisters regulation. A couple of things that we just wanted to bring out to the board and to the stakeholder and public feedback is in our regulations, we talk about the application process, and in order for an in-person assistance program or an entity to participate in that program, they have to apply in order to participate, and we have to determine whether or not they're a qualifying organization in order to say that they can be a part of our sister network capacity. And information about in the event that the application that we receive from the organization has some missing information, giving us the authority to follow up with the organization. And once the organization is determined eligible to participate, they will have to go through a training program in order to be certified by us. For the individual assisters, which are the individuals who work for the enrollment entity or the assister enrollment entity, and they would have to be affiliated to an organization, basically be employed by the organization, and they will also, from the individual perspective, have to submit an application as well as pass an assister fingerprinting check and to complete training as well. And in the event that they, for some reason, do not pass the fingerprinting or background check, they were denied for any particular reason outside of that, they would be able to have appeal rights to dispute that determination. And here is a information about the appeals process. Basically, if they don't agree with the background check, they have two options. Or they can elect all of the above. They can go directly to Department of Justice or Federal Bureau of Investigation to refute the information contained in the background check. Or they can submit information directly to us to say that, you know, there are situations in which they encountered that were exceptional and that they would like for us to revisit the interim decision. And then the appeals process in And the appeals process in which it could be a situation where it is not within the fingerprinting background check, it's just something completely different, they can also appeal because people should have the right to, you know, dispute. And through their appeals process, we will institute an informal resolution process as well as formalize an appeals adjudication, which is pretty consistent with the appeals process and proposed federal regs for consumers. And with that, this is just some general timelines of our assisters program and our next steps. And we are soliciting feedback again through May 14th. And with that, I'd like to open it up to the board or to the public.
I'd actually wait, if we could, Madam Chair, to have Katie Ravel present on what also relates to this area, the agent enrollment entity relationship requirements, to have the board ask questions of either of you or public comment on both of those topics.
Great. Thanks,
great.
Tian.
Thank you, Tian.
Good morning, Katie.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Are we losing our quorum at 12:30?
I think we're going to push it, but 12:30 is pretty hard.
Okay.
And we need public comment.
We're going to go quickly then. I assume the slides will appear.
Bob, can you stay beyond 12:30?
I can do 12:45.
Okay. Thanks. And Paul, because I know Kim is leaving. I know we're really tight, but we're trying. I know. Okay. Go, Katie.
Okay. So This is a recommendation regarding potential financial partnerships between agents and other enrollment entities. When the slides do come up, you'll see that the first slide has just kind of reiterates some of our enrollment assistance principles that bear on this issue. TN's covered them, so I'll skip to slide two, which is a reminder of our enrollment assistance channels and some requirements, including the fact that we have an all-hands-on-deck approach. No wrong door, many channels, including grantees, will do outreach and education, a community outreach network, which is uncompensated individuals who will help us get the word out about our program. Assisters who will generally be paid $58 for completing a successful application, and then agents will be paid by plans on a commission basis. The applicable Covered California enrollment assistance requirement here is that our certified enrollment assisters and agents are required to enroll applicants in all insurance affordability programs for which they're eligible. This includes our Medi-Cal and CHIP programs. And a couple applicable federal and state statutory requirements that bear on this policy are in the Affordable Care Act and its implementing regulations, which prohibit assisters from receiving direct or indirect compensation from health insurance issuers, and also a California insurance code, which prohibits licensed agents from compensating unlicensed individuals, which would include assisters, from recommending that clients purchase insurance from particular agents. So with that, let's do a quick overview of the issue here, which is the subject of the recommendation that we'll get to. We do have a compensation difference between assisters and agents, which could create, we believe, a potential for financial partnerships in which agents compensate our grantees, assisters, or other unaffiliated community-based organizations for providing referrals or additional enrollment assistance. And allowing financial arrangements between agents and assisters or community-based organizations could result in an increase in the cost of marketing and enrollment assistance, including agent compensation, which is overall reflected in our health plan costs, which, as we know, we have a principle to keep our health plan costs as affordable as possible. And then finally, we are encouraging non-monetary partnerships among all groups offering enrollment assistance, and that's reflected in the principles that the board adopted. So with that, our recommendation here, and this is for discussion today and action at May 23rd, is that to address this potential financial partnerships that could increase the overall cost of enrollment and could conflict with federal and state law, as I've mentioned, two recommendations. Prohibit grantees and assisters from accepting compensation from agents for referrals or enrollment services, and these would be our trained and certified assisters and grantees, and then prohibit agents who are trained and certified by Covered California from providing the compensation to grantees, assisters, or other community-based groups. And we would just note that this wouldn't apply to individual agents who aren't trained and certified by Covered California. The paper that you have lists some implementation considerations, which I won't go into in the interest of time, but they're there for the public to comment on, and we're asking for comments by Friday, May 17th on this paper.
Great. Thank you very much, Katie and Tim. Peter, do you have anything to add?
Just the two things. One, there is a full board recommendation brief that we released on April 23rd that we're asking comment on. Second, I would note that and I don't remember if I noted earlier that next week on May 14th, we'll be announcing the community outreach and education grant recipients. We're very excited about the grant recipients that we'll be partnering with. As Tien spoke about, one of the factors we looked at in selecting those partners is groups that could serve as certified entities to have assisters. So it's a platform for many of those groups. We're particularly strong because of that, and these are linked issues. But we're very excited about that announcement next week.
Great. Thanks, Peter. And Kim, I know you've got to scoot. Is there anything that you want to add before we open it for public comment?
Maybe at another time I'd like to hear a little bit more from Tien in terms of the assisters program and training, in terms of how we intend to go about certification and what kind of quality assurance program and activities we anticipate putting into place.
Great. Thanks, Kim. Paul?
I can stay for about 10 more minutes.
Okay, great. Thanks, Kim.
Actually, I'll just add to what Kim said, and I don't really need it now, but could be in a future agenda, which relates to training, but to expand a little bit. You know, we have a very aggressive schedule. There's an extraordinary amount of work to do, but I'd be curious to know a little bit more about your sense of preparedness in terms of training, about having the resources, about preparing those resources, and where we stand. Don't need to know that now, but I think it would be good for the board to be kept abreast of that. The second related issue is I would imagine that well, it's all but certain that once assisters are trained and out there, that early on, particularly in early weeks and months, they themselves are going to have an extraordinary number of questions and need for support, and I don't know how that's going to occur. Are they going to be calling the call center? Will their own organizations, of which they may be a part, intended to be accountable for some of that? Well, what is the plan in relation to supporting assisters, not just getting them trained, but once they're out in the field?
Yes, and we're all very concerned about that, and we've talked with many of you about it, and it is a consistent theme of concern, on the part of the board. So I will open it for public comment. And Bob, if you would let me know when you have people at your microphone, we will go back and forth.
We're good right now.
Great. Thanks, Bob. Public comment on this item.
We have a question from
Great. Nancy Gomez. Let's go ahead and take the phone because people are still queuing up. Open the line, please.
Okay. Secretary. Nancy Gomez, Health Access. Please go ahead.
Okay. Hello. I have a comment and a question regarding the assisters. The Health Access office in Los Angeles has been getting a number of calls from individuals wanting to become assisters and wondering where they can sign up. This implies that a component of your outreach is definitely working and reaching communities. And you just stated that individuals must be affiliated to an organization in order to become an assister, and I'm sure there's no shortage of potential assisters, but are you concerned that this will create a shortage, particularly in rural areas? My other question is, keeping in mind that some applicants will not be English proficient, will the training be offered in Spanish or in other threshold languages?
Thank you for your comments, and we'll collect all the questions and answer them at the end, please. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Tim Smith with the Local Health Plans of California.
There you go. Thanks,
Tim. Tim Smith with the Local Health Plans of California. We are concerned that... Sorry about that. We are concerned that non-qualified health plans were not included in the list of organizations that can become that can participate in the assister program. Qualified health plans are covered under the model contract, and non-qualified health plans, which many of our members are, which are the COs and LIs, are already doing a lot of enrollment for Medi-Cal and for Healthy Families. This is a natural pairing, so we would like to see them included in the draft regulations as one of the types of organizations that can be an assister.
Great. Thank you for your comments.
This is Athena Chapman with the California Association of Health Plans, and I'd just like to support what LHPC just said about non-QHPs being eligible to be assisters. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Athena.
Hi, I'm Mark Deal with the Children's Health Initiative in Napa County, and I just want to first thank you for working hard to keep premium costs down. We're really concerned about where premiums might go with this. But I am concerned about the policy moving forward to block agents and navigators from working together. In Napa County, we partner with 37 different groups throughout the community, including the agent broker community. And we're more concerned about having as many doors as possible to get people enrolled. And I personally think at this point in time, we should be working to expand options instead of limit ways that people can get covered. And I'll submit written comments with more details. But thank you very much for everything you're doing.
Yeah, thank you for your comments.
Good afternoon, Carla Saporta with the Green Lighting Institute. I just want to start by really just saying my deep appreciation to the staff for working with us along with other colleagues on the fingerprinting and background check issue. We've come to a lot of agreement on many of these policies, and we really feel that the assister regulations do reflect a lot of these agreements, including requiring that any disqualifying offenses have a substantial relationship to the duties and qualifications or functions of the employment sought, and also that the regulations do outline an appeal process and an interim determination process as well. We do have a couple clarifying issues that we've brought forward. First, if anybody has an issue with their background check that shows a disqualifying factor that they don't believe should be on their record, we believe that the person should be able to just go directly to the exchange rather than have to work with DOJ or the FBI. And then also, we would just like further clarification on the factors of mitigating circumstances and evidence of rehabilitation. And we look forward to working with the staff to work these things out as well. And then last, on the agents and enrollment entities relationship, we support the recommendation put forward by staff because we really feel that this is going to best protect consumers. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Carla.
Good afternoon, board and members. Autumn Ogden with California Coverage and Health Initiatives. We wanted to address first, we have some concerns regarding the errors and omissions coverage. As you know, there's not current federal guidance in this area, and we believe that it may not be appropriate or necessary. Furthermore, there are not existing lines of E&O coverage, so we have concerns about the cost of obtaining this coverage for some of the smaller CBOs moving forward being so high that it creates a barrier. So we just wanted to comment on that. We also would like to comment on the agent and enrollment entities relationship. As you heard from Mark Deal, we have some concerns. CCHI is currently looking into it, as some of our members have certain relationships that may be prohibited under this guidance. So we will be looking further into that and submitting further comment. And then we just we have some on the proposed assister regs. Under the definition of assisters and navigators, we are curious why there was not an inclusion of direct benefit assisters and a definition and how they would become enrolled as uncovered or how they would be providing coverage, how they would gain
certification.
Thank you. And then finally, on the organizations eligible to be trained and registered by the exchange for the consumer assistance, you have enrollment entities stated that it should be registered either as a navigator program or an in-person assistance program, but not both. Placing the organizations into one of two categories, either as a navigator entity by a grant or an in-person assister compensated through an entity. Anyways, we have some concerns if this is a hard and fast rule as things progress. If people enroll as one, they might find a need to want to enroll in the other program. So thank you.
Thank you. Betsy, let me just pause there for a minute. Bob, you have a speaker in your queue down there, if we'll go to Los Angeles.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon, Mari Lopez with Vision and Compromiso. I just wanted some clarification on the similarities between in-person assistance programs and the navigator program. Conducting public education activities to raise awareness of the availability of Covered California is not a reimbursable activity. Why was it excluded as in comparison to the navigator program that is included?
Thank you for your comment and question. We'll come back to answer all the questions at the end. Betsy.
Betsy Imholtz for Consumers Union. A couple things. First, I want to speak in support of the staff recommendation. In the interest of keeping assistance as neutral as possible, as unbiased, in the interest of complying with state and federal law, and in the interest also of containing health system costs, we think this is a wise way to go to prohibit financial relationships between assisters and agents. And we don't think it prohibits them working together. I think the whole goal is to have all hands on deck working together, but it's the issue of money changing hands. Secondly, on the regulations, we want to thank staff for their hard work on the fingerprinting issue. Very difficult issues, balancing those interests between protecting financial privacy on the one hand and making sure that we have folks in the communities who can assist appropriately. And we continue to work with them. We appreciate the substantial relationship language that's been added to the regs and the two-step appeal process, and we'll continue to work with them closely on that. Finally, I just wanted to raise one issue about the curriculum for assisters. I think Mr. Farah has raised a really good point about the ongoing assistance needs that they'll have. Assisters will need assistance. But also about marketing abuses. We view them as the front line in the community who will be seeing any marketing abuses that might come up, and so we want to make sure that's part of the curriculum and that they are tied back in with you in an organized way so that we can sort of stop those kinds of misrepresentations before they get out of control. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Betsy.
Hi, this is Megan McCammon with the California Primary Care Association. And we'd like to thank the exchange staff for all of their hard work in perfecting these assisters regulations. We have one note that we think is very important. We noted that community clinics are listed as eligible for compensation as in-person assisters, while clinics are listed as ineligible. And there's no definition in the document about what a community clinic is versus a clinic. It's causing mass confusion among our health centers. And just wanted to let the exchange staff know that we will we look forward to working with them to include strong definitions in the final document. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Dave Schmidt with Wells Fargo Insurance Services. Just wanted to comment on the ability for brokers to share in some of the cost with assisters. We can see sometimes that there would be assisters would incur costs if they're assisting us in open enrollment meetings that require travel. And for us not to be able to cover some of those costs could be would put the assister in a situation where we'd have to put them on a Skype situation, and employees that might be getting coverage would be treated as a second-class citizen in that type of a meeting rather than being able to do a face-to-face meeting. So we don't think that that is necessarily positive to be an outcome. So that's the comment related to that, related to this subject.
Great. Thank you for your comments.
Vanessa Hina with the Western Center on Law and Poverty. We very much appreciate the work of the staff and the board members, along with stakeholders, to ensuring that those with access to confidential and private and sensitive information go through appropriate screening processes. We would concur our comments with those of Consumers Union as to the difficult negotiation that this has been, but say that we will look forward to working on the regulations as they come forward to ensure that all individuals are accurately screened and that they go through a good appeals process, so that assisters can really look like the people whom they're serving. We will also very much appreciate the substantial relationship language, and we applaud the board's commitment to a no-wrong-door approach in requiring all assister entities to provide assistance to all kinds of coverage, including Medi-Cal. Thank you.
Thanks, Vanessa.
Beth Cavell for Health Access California. To comment specifically in support of the staff's recommendation with respect to agent and enrollment entities, and to note that in your board brief, it speaks to accepting payment or other valuable consideration, and we would commend that to you. It would seem to me quite natural that we might have a circumstance in which an agent, meaning well, would offer free office space, phone, travel, not meaning any harm, but thus biasing what should be unbiased representations. And we think those kinds of considerations are contemplated in your own disclosures as public officials, and so we would commend a slightly broader understanding of that. Thank you.
Thanks, Beth. We have one person on the phone. Operator, if you'd open that line, please.
Julie Broyles from California Health, please go ahead.
Hi, Julie Broyles, the California Association of Health Underwriters. Thank you for taking the time to listen to our comment. We did have just one point we'd like to make on the assisters and agents working together. Our concern is that everyone should be having an ability to get people enrolled into the exchange. We are fully supportive of that process and would urge the board to make sure that we don't close doors unnecessarily where agents and other organizations can work together to get people coverage through the exchange, whether it's in SHOP or in the individual Covered California Exchange. We think that we shouldn't be dividing into small boats, but that we should be, you know, lashing our boats together to make sure that everyone gets into the process. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for your comments. Peter.
I am not going to try.
Bob, is there anything left in Los Angeles that we missed?
No, we're good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Thanks, Bob.
If I may, I think a few of the questions are addressed in full read of the background material. These are complex issues. The issues by federal law, what's a navigator, are laid out in law. We've tried to parse this out. I think this has been a very good set of comments that we listen to acutely. We welcome people's follow-up comments in writing on the two separate deadlines and two separate addresses, you'll note by email, just to keep you guys on your toes. Whichever email you send it to, info@HBEX or info@CoveredCA, we'll get them either way. We welcome your comments between now and the respective due dates, and we look forward to coming back to this on May 23rd.
Anything else?
No.
Anything else? We are adjourned. We will see you in about 10 more days.